Chapter 7. At a dinner given by the Lord Mayor at the Mansion House, on the above date, Mr. Justice Telford proposed as a toast Anglo-Saxon literature, and alluded to Mr. Dickens as having employed fiction as a means of awakening attention to the condition of the oppressed and suffering classes. Mr. Dickens replied to this toast in a graceful and playful strain. In the former part of the evening, in reply to a toast on the Chancery Department, Vice Chancellor Wood, who spoke in the absence of the Lord Chancellor, made a sort of defense of the Court of Chancery, not distinctly alluding to Bleak House, but evidently not without reference to it. The amount of what he said was, that the court had received a great many more hard opinions than it merited, that they had been parsimoniously obliged to perform a great amount of business by a very inadequate number of judges, but that more recently the number of judges had been increased to 7, and there was reason to hope that all business brought before it would now be performed without unnecessary delay. Mr. Dickens alluded playfully to this item of intelligence, said he was exceedingly happy to hear it, as he trusted now that a suit, in which he was greatly interested, would speedily come to an end. I heard a little by conversation between Mr. Dickens and a gentleman of the bar, who sat opposite me, in which the latter seemed to be reiterating the same assertions, and I understood him to say that a case not extraordinarily complicated might be got through within 3 months. Mr. Dickens said he was very happy to hear it, but I fancied there was a little shade of incredulity in his manner. However, the incident showed one thing, that is, that the Chancery were not insensible to the representations of Dickens, but the whole tone of the thing was quite good-natured and agreeable. 10. Speech. Birmingham, December 30, 1853. The first of the readings generously given by Mr. Charles Dickens on behalf of the Birmingham and Midland Institute took place on Tuesday evening, December 27, 1853 at the Birmingham Town Hall, where, notwithstanding the inclemency of the weather, nearly 2,000 persons had assembled. The work selected was The Christmas Carol. The high mimetic powers possessed by Mr. Dickens enabled him to personate with remarkable force the various characters of the story, and with admirable skill, to pass rapidly from the hard unbelieving Scrooge, to trusting and thankful Bob Cratchit, and from the genial fullness of Scrooge's nephew, to the hideous mirth of the party assembled in old Joe the rack shopkeeper's parlor. The reading occupied more than 3 hours, but so interested were the audience, that only one or two left the hall previously to its termination, and the loud and frequent bursts of applause attested the successful discharge of the reader's arduous task. On Thursday evening Mr. Dickens read The Cricket on the Hearth. The hall was again well ruled, and the tale, though deficient in the dramatic interest of the carol, was listened to with attention, and rewarded with repeated applause. On Friday evening, The Christmas Carol was read a second time to a large assemblage of workpeople, for whom, at Mr. Dickens' special request, the major part of the vast edifice was reserved. Before commencing the tale, Mr. Dickens delivered the following brief address, almost every sentence of which was received with loudly expressed applause. My good friends, when I first imparted to the committee of the projected institute my particular wish, that on one of the evenings of my readings here the main body of my audience should be composed of working men and their families, I was animated by two desires. First, by the wish to have the great pleasure of meeting you face to face at this Christmas time, and accompany you myself through one of my little Christmas books, and second, by the wish to have an opportunity of stating publicly in your presence, and in the presence of the committee, my earnest hope that the Institute will, from the beginning, recognize one great principle strong in reason and justice which I believe to be essential to the very life of such an institution. It is, that the working man shall, from the first unto the last, have a share in the management of an institution which is designed for his benefit, and which calls itself by his name. I have no fear here of being misunderstood, of being supposed to mean too much in this. If there ever was a time when any one class could of itself do much for its own good, and for the welfare of society, which I greatly doubt, that time is unquestionably past. It is in the fusion of different classes, without confusion, in the bringing together of employers and employed, in the creating of a better common understanding among those whose interests are identical, who depend upon each other, who are vitally essential to each other, and who never can be in unnatural antagonism without deplorable results, that one of the chief principles of a mechanics institution should consist. In this world, a great deal of the bitterness among us arises from an imperfect understanding of one another. Erect in Birmingham a great educational institution, properly educational, educational of the feelings as well as of the reason, to which all orders of Birmingham men contribute, in which all orders of Birmingham men meet, wherein all orders of Birmingham men are faithfully represented, and you will erect a temple of concord here which will be a model edifice to the whole of England. Contemplating as I do the existence of the Artisans' Committee, which not long ago considered the establishment of the Institute so sensibly, and supported it so heartily, I earnestly entreat the gentlemen earnest I know in the good work, and who are now among us, by all means to avoid the great shortcoming of similar institutions, and in asking the working man for his confidence, to set him the great example, and give him theirs in return. You will judge for yourselves, if I promise too much for the working man, when I say, that he will stand by such an enterprise with the utmost of his patience, his perseverance, sense, and support, that I am sure he will need no charitable aid or condescending patronage, but will readily and cheerfully pay for the advantages which it confers. That he will prepare himself in individual cases where he feels that the adverse circumstances around him have rendered it necessary. In a word, that he will feel his responsibility like an honest man, and will most honestly and manfully discharge it. I now proceed to the pleasant task to which I assure you I have looked forward for a long time.
At the close of the reading, Mr. Dickens received a vote of thanks, and three cheers, with 3 times 3. As soon as the enthusiasm of the audience would allow him to speak, Mr. Dickens said,
"You have heard so much of my voice since we met tonight that I will only say, in acknowledgement of this affecting mark of your regard, that I am truly and sincerely interested in you. That any little service I have rendered to you, I have freely rendered from my heart, that I hope to become an honorary member of your great institution, and will meet you often there, when it becomes practically useful, that I thank you most affectionately for this new mark of your sympathy and approval, and that I wish you many happy returns of this great birthday time, and many prosperous years." Speech. Commercial Travelers. London, December 30, 1854.
The following speech was made by Mr. Dickens at the anniversary dinner in commemoration of the foundation of the Commercial Travellers' Schools, held at the London Tavern on the above date. Mr. Dickens presided on this occasion, and proposed the toasts.
"I think it may be assumed that most of us here present know something about travelling. I do not mean in distant regions or foreign countries, although I dare say some of us have had experience in that way, but at home, and within the limits of the United Kingdom. I dare say most of us have had experience of the extinct fast coaches, the Wonders, the Glionis, and the Lihos, of other days. I dare say most of us remember certain modest post chaises, dragging us down interminable roads, through slush and mud, to little country towns with no visible population, except half a dozen men in smock frocks, half a dozen women with umbrellas and pattens, and a washed-out dog or so shivering under the gables, to complete the desolate picture. We can all discourse, I dare say, if so minded, about our recollections of the Talbot, the Queen's Head, or the Lion of those days. We have all been to that room on the ground floor on one side of the old inn yard,
not quite free from a certain fragrant smell of tobacco, where the cruets on the sideboard were usually absorbed by the skirts of the boxcoats that hung from the wall, where awkward servants waylaid us at every turn, like so many human man traps, where county members, framed and glazed, were eternally presenting that petition which, somehow or other, had made their glory in the county, although nothing else had ever come of it. Where the books in the windows always wanted the first, last, and middle leaves, and where the one man was always arriving at some unusual hour in the night, and requiring his breakfast at a similarly singular period of the day. I have no doubt we could all be very eloquent on the comforts of our favorite hotel, wherever it was, its beds, its stables, its vast amount of posting, its excellent cheese, its head waiter, its capital dishes, its pigeon pies, or its 1820 port. Or possibly we could recall our chaste and innocent admiration of its landlady, or our fraternal regard for its handsome chambermaid. A celebrated domestic critic, once writing of a famous actress, renowned for her virtue and beauty, gave her the character of being an eminently gatherable to one's arms sort of person. Perhaps someone amongst us has borne a somewhat similar tribute to the mental charms of the fair deities who presided at our hotels. With the traveling characteristics of later times, we are all, no doubt, equally familiar. We know all about that station to which we must take our ticket, although we never get there, and the other one at which we arrive after dark, certain to find it half a mile from the town, where the old road is sure to have been abolished, and the new road is going to be made, where the old neighborhood has been tumbled down, and the new one is not half built up. We know all about that party on the platform who, with the best intentions, can do nothing for our luggage except pitch it into all sorts of unattainable places. We know all about that short omnibus, in which one is to be doubled up, to the imminent danger of the crown of one's hat, and about that fly, whose leading peculiarity is never to be there when it is wanted. We know, too, how instantaneously the lights of the station disappear when the train starts, and about that grope to the new railway hotel, which will be an excellent house when the customers come, but which at present has nothing to offer but a liberal allowance of damp mortar and new lime. I record these little incidents of home travel mainly with the object of increasing your interest in the purpose of this night's assemblage. Every traveler has a home of his own, and he learns to appreciate it the more from his wandering. If he has no home, he learns the same lesson unselfishly, by turning to the homes of other men. He may have his experiences of cheerful and exciting pleasures abroad, but home is the best, after all, and its pleasures are the most heartily and enduringly prized. Therefore, ladies and gentlemen, everyone must be prepared to learn that commercial travelers, as a body, know how to prize those domestic relations from which their pursuits so frequently sever them, for no one could possibly invent a more delightful or more convincing testimony to the fact than they themselves have offered in founding and maintaining a school for the children of deceased or unfortunate members of their own body. Those children who now appeal to you in mute, but eloquent terms from the gallery. It is to support that school, founded with such high and friendly objects, so very honorable to your calling, and so useful in its solid and practical results, that we are here tonight. It is to roof, that building which is to shelter the children of your deceased friends with one crowning ornament, the best that any building can have, namely, a receipt stamp for the full amount of the cost. It is for this that your active sympathy is appealed to, for the completion of your own good work. You know how to put your hands to the plow in earnest as well as any men in existence, for this little book informs me that you raised last year no less a sum than £8,000, and while fully half of that sum consisted of new donations to the building fund, I find that the regular revenue of the charity has only suffered to the extent of £30. After this, I most earnestly and sincerely say that were we all authors together, I might boast, if in my profession were exhibited the same unity and steadfastness I find in yours. I will not urge on you the casualties of a life of travel, or the vicissitudes of business, or the claims fostered by that bond of brotherhood which ought always to exist amongst men who are united in a common pursuit. You have already recognized those claims so nobly that I will not presume to lay them before you in any further detail. Suffice it to say that I do not think it is in your nature to do things by halves. I do not think you could do so if you tried, and I have a moral certainty that you never will try. To those gentlemen present who are not members of the traveler's body, I will say in the words of the French proverb, "Heaven helps those who help themselves." The commercial travelers having helped themselves so gallantly, it is clear that the visitors who come as a sort of celestial representatives ought to bring that aid in their pockets which the precept teaches us to expect from them. With these few remarks, I beg to give you as a toast, success to the commercial traveler school. In proposing the health of the army in the Crimea, Mr. Dickens said, "It does not require any extraordinary sagacity in a commercial assembly to appreciate the dire evils of war. The great interests of trade enfeebled by it, the enterprise of better times paralyzed by it, all the peaceful arts bent down before it, to palpably indicate its character and results, so that far less practical intelligence than that by which I am surrounded would be sufficient to appreciate the horrors of war. But there are seasons when the evils of peace, though not so acutely felt, are immeasurably greater, and when a powerful nation, by admitting the right of any autocrat to do wrong, sows by such complicity the seeds of its own ruin, and overshadows itself in time to come with that fatal influence which great and ambitious powers are sure to exercise over their weaker neighbors. Therefore it is, ladies and gentlemen, that the tree has not its root in English ground from which the yard wand can be made, that will measure the mind has not its place in English soil that will supply the material of a pair of scales to weigh the influence that may be at stake in the war in which we are now straining all our energies. That war is, at any time and in any shape, a most dreadful and deplorable calamity, we need no proverb to tell us. But it is just because it is such a calamity, and because that calamity must not forever be impending over us at the fancy of one man against all mankind, that we must not allow that man to darken from our view the figures of peace and justice between whom and us he now interposes. Ladies and gentlemen, if ever there were a time when the true spirits of two countries were really fighting in the cause of human advancement and freedom, no matter what diplomatic notes or other nameless botherations, from number 1 to 100,001, may have preceded their taking the field, if ever there were a time when noble hearts were deserving well of mankind, by exposing themselves to the obedient bayonets of a rash and barbarian tyrant, it is now, when the faithful children of England and France are fighting so bravely in the Crimea. Those faithful children are the admiration and wonder of the world, so gallantly are they discharging their duty. And therefore I propose to an assembly, emphatically representing the interests and arts of peace, to drink Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.